funny?
I won't start.
That's funny.
Try turning the key the other way.
Oh.
Thanks.
Who said that?
Junk Food Dinner, episode 65. This week, a group of teens accidentally kill a drug dealer. But when he returns from the grave, thanks to some radioactive sludge, the friends must sacrifice one of their own to take him on in the 1987 horror comedy, I Was a Teenage Zombie. Then, we take a gruesome look at one of America's most infamous cult leaders and the events that led to the murders that shocked the nation when we examine the horrific biopic, The Manson Family, from 2004. And finally, the wacky worlds of rock and roll and professional wrestling collide in the 1986 goofball comedy, Body Slam.
What do you want?
I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business.
Welcome to Junk Food Dinner, episode 65. This is the podcast where each week we scour the internet, video stores, and cable television, looking for the most outrageous and interesting cult films. We're not professional film journalists or critics by any means. We are simply three geeks from Ohio with entirely too much time on our hands. In Ohio, I'm Kevin Moss, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Mark Fredo in New York and Parker Bowman in California. Every week, we'll each be bringing a cult favorite to the table, recalling our personal experiences with the film, discussing its merits, and arguing why we did or did not enjoy it. This week, we'll be taking a look at I Was a Teenage Zombie from 1987, then The Manson Family from 2004, and finally Body Slam from 1986. But first, gentlemen, how are you doing this week?
Doing pretty good.
I'm also good.
Excellent. Yeah, how did the Alone in the T-Shirt Zone screening go last night?
It was great. It was awesome. We sold out, so packed house. People were really excited. It was a lot of fun. There were some technical difficulties, but we had an intro from Mike Anderson and Jennifer Anderson, and that was totally awesome. It was really fun. So
cool.
Look forward to next month when we do Samurai Cop.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely want to give thanks to the Spectacle Theater for letting Mark and the crew put that together and show that there. And thanks to, Mike B. Anderson and everyone who gave their blessing. So that was, that's really cool that you got to do that. And hopefully there will be a lot more in the future.
Yeah, Spectacle's great. They're very supportive and receptive to us doing stuff. And, it's been a lot of fun.
Cool. Yeah, I got to hang with fellow podcasters, the kids from Kissing Contest, Mike, Dick, and Sawyer. They were down in my neck of the woods in Cincinnati on Monday night, and got to hang out with them. And, that was cool, despite the fact that they just kept continuously talking shit about My Fair City. But to be fair.
Yes, to be fair, you live in Cincinnati.
Well, they also saw the worst parts of Cincinnati, which were Clifton and my neighborhood. So they really didn't get the gold tour. But nevertheless, we had fun.
You should have hopped over the river and gone to that aquarium. That's the best part of Cincinnati.
Oh, baloney.
Oh, you can touch those sharks?
Yeah.
That's cool.
That is cool. But yeah, we had a fun time, and it was nice to finally meet the guys from Kissing Contest in person after hearing their golden voices for all these many years.
Did they look like what you thought they would after hearing them?
Oh, no, not at all. And I'm sure they probably felt the same thing about me.
Yeah.
If they actually listen to this podcast, which I still suspect that they don't.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I am very curious what you guys look like.
Yeah. When I finally meet you guys, it's going to be
weird. In my mind, I have like a very specific idea of what you guys look like, but it's probably not very realistic.
Yeah. I'm a hideous, hideous man. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, maybe it is pretty realistic then.
I apologize for making fun of Cincinnati. I shouldn't have done that.
No, it's okay.
I live in a terrible place.
Easy to do from your ivory tower in California there.
Yeah. I'm surrounded by manure and cockroaches and spiders. I shouldn't be making fun of any cities. I apologize.
All right, well, let's get into some listener feedback. We got some good listener feedback this week. The first piece of listener feedback we have comes from our longtime listener, Vincent Lurch. He says, "Hey, what's up, guys? I was curious if any of you guys have seen Hobo with a Shotgun. If you guys did it, I think it would be a good movie to review. Plus, I don't want to make a blind purchase like I did with the Hatchet 2 Blu-ray aka high def piece of shit. Also, I got a theme suggestion. I was thinking about it would be cool if you guys did a show on TV episodes like your favorite Twilight Zones or Tales from the Dark Side, etc. So yeah, thank you, Vincent. I have not seen Hubba with a Shotgun yet. I don't think that's got an official release on home video yet, and I don't think it's played in any theaters in my area. I think it's available on demand somehow online, but I'm sure, you know, bootleg copies are floating around. But yeah, I'll probably wait till I can see that officially, because I do want to see it, and it looks really good. But yeah, I think that would be fun to do, and I would love to do like a, you know, kind of go off the beaten path and cover some TV shows and stuff at one point. I mean, not make that a regular thing, but nevertheless, there's lots of cool TV that I think would be fun to talk about as well.
That would be a fun episode.
Yeah.
I agree.
You guys had a chance to see Hubba with a Shotgun yet?
It was on Comcast In Demand, and I was thinking about getting it. But those in-demand movies are like $8, and I figured if I was going to spend $8 to see a movie, I might as well just spend another $12 and go to the actual movies. So I haven't seen it yet.
Right.
But I hear it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't actually been able to check it out yet. I missed that screening, and then I don't have cable, so I can't get the on-demand stuff. But yeah, I am very interested in seeing it.
Yeah, so we'll probably check that out once it becomes more readily available, and yeah, we'll probably have a review shortly afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Next piece of listener feedback comes to us from Joseph. He says, "Dear JFD, I first want to tell you guys that your podcast is just the best. I've been following you guys since the Tough Guys podcast show, 40-something, and I look forward to hearing your take on classic cult flicks every week and then adding the films I don't already own to my ever-growing to-buy list. You guys keep me laughing out loud while I'm at my shitty job. Anywho, I guess to get to my point, my suggestion is End of Days from 1999, one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's greatest and least talked about films. It's like a shitty Rosemary's Baby mixed with a hard-hitting action cop drama. Pure cheese. P.S. Also, I know one of you dudes is based in California. In October, I'm honeymooning in San Francisco. I'm looking for some great movie buying stores. I know Amoeba and Rasputin are supposed to be good for DVDs, but I'm looking for some hidden gems, the uncut shit. This is from Joe." So, thanks, Joe. He also says, "P.P.S. Fuck Seth Putnam." So, obviously, he wasn't an anal cunt fan. So, yeah, Parker, you got any recommendations for Joe on where he should go to buy DVDs when he's in California?
In San Francisco, I've been to the Amoeba there, the San Francisco one, not the Berkeley one, and it is awesome. Like, I wouldn't imagine there's any other place to go while you're there. I mean, it's like the size of a super Walmart, and pretty much everything you could ever want was there, or at least I thought so when I was there. So I would forgo those hidden gems and go straight there, because
cool.
It's awesome. I don't know, it's like the coolest record store ever, and it's got like the best, like, even the DVD section in this record store is like the size of Best Buy. It's insane, and it's all just nudie cuties. That's all they got is nudie.
Very cool. The next piece of listener feedback I have is from Ron. This is from Facebook. He says, "Love the podcast, guys. I have a suggestion for a film to include on the podcast, Bloody Wednesday. It's a little-known film. Not sure if you guys have seen it, but it's pretty crazy, and I thought it had some memorable scenes. Saw it back in the late 80s on VHS when I was pretty young." So, yeah, I have never heard of that movie, but I would definitely like to check that out. So thanks for the suggestion, Ron.
Yeah, good name.
Yeah.
Yeah, I looked at part of it. There's a clip on YouTube, and I don't know what it's in context to, but it's just a guy shooting lots of people with an Uzi. So I was like, I don't know if this is the end of the movie, the beginning, somewhere in the middle, but count me in.
That's hopefully it's the entire movie.
Yeah, it was just a short, like, 2-minute clip of the entire 90 minutes, which is also just Uzi shootings.
All right, well, let's get into some nerd news.
From the global resources of Junk Food Dinner Worldwide, it's time for Nerd News.
All right, so the first piece of nerd news we have, and again, an ever-continuing segment on the show. Hey, guess who died this week? Well,
ew.
As you would may have heard, legendary actor Peter Falk, best known for his starring role in the television series Columbo and his appearances in films like The In-Laws and The Princess Bride, passed away at the age of 83 this week. Peter Falk, the 5-time Emmy Award-winning actor, best known for his starring roles in Columbo, was 83 when he died. He died peacefully at his home in Beverly Hills, California. He had been suffering from Alzheimer's disease and dementia for several years. He is survived by his wife
and his daughters. So sad to hear. I mean, obviously he was getting up in years, so not wholly unexpected. But nevertheless, it's sad to see Columbo go. You guys fond of Peter Falk's work, or?
I do like Peter Falk. Yeah. You know, obviously Princess Bride, but I really like Murder by Death. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So good. I was trying to watch it the other day when I heard about it, because my roommates have never seen it, and I was just quoting it at them, and they were less excited about it than I was. But yeah, very funny movie, great cast, and he's fantastic in it.
Yeah, he's also been in a lot of TV stuff that mm-hmm. you might have seen. He was in, you know, a lot of episodes of The Twilight Zone and Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Have Gun Will Travel, a lot of the old black and white stuff that I really like. It seems like he popped up in all the time. So, yeah, he was a really good actor, always a good presence, mm-hmm. really good delivery. And so, yeah, rest in peace, Peter Falk. Next piece of nerd news that I have is it looks like Wet Hot American Summer may be getting a prequel sometime in the near future. Director David Wayne, known for his work with The State and more recently comedies like Role Models, stated that he was planning in the planning stages of a prequel to the star-studded cult classic Wet Hot American Summer. Fans were ecstatic, but a lot of people were doubtful of whether or not it would really happen. Some of the stars like Paul Rudd and Elizabeth Banks, who star in the upcoming movie together, our idiot brother, have both stated that they would both be totally on board with the prequel. One of the funny things I thought about this was that, you know, obviously being a prequel, it's going to be set before the first movie, yet all the actors are about 10 years older. And I think that, like, one of the jokes will be that, you know, you've got 40-year-old actors playing, like, 16-year-olds, and that will be hilarious. But, you know, who they will get from the original 2001 cast to come back and make an appearance is yet to be determined, but nevertheless, just the fact that this is in planning stages made me super excited, as Wet Hot American Summer is one of my all-time favorite comedies, and anything having to do with it would definitely get me excited. So did you guys hear about this news?
I did not, but I'm very excited about that. That sounds delightful.
Yeah.
I love Wet Hot American Summer. I feel like this could go either way, though. I didn't really see Role Models. I heard terrible things about The 10 and just some of the other things.
Oh, no, The 10.
10's good.
Yeah, 10 is really good.
Well, that is the first two good things I've heard about it.
No, it's well worth seeing if you like that style of humor.
Maybe we should do The 10 on the show. Like, that's a good movie. And also Role Models was surprisingly funny, too.
Yeah, Role Models wasn't bad either. Yeah, I have total faith in David Wayne to churn out hilarious stuff. And I think if, you know, he did do a prequel to Wet Hot American Summer, I think he would probably have, you know, full creative control, and I don't think he would be doing it for a paycheck. It would definitely be a labor of love, and I think they'd kind of revert back to the goofy humor that made Wet Hot American Summer so endearing. So if they were to make it, I have faith that it would be well worth the...
I would check it out, you know, no matter what, but I am hesitant to get my hopes up immediately.
Understood.
Yeah, there's actually a thing going on in LA right now. They've got like some art gallery open where like all these many people have done paintings of things from Wet Hot American Summer, like different scenes, and they're showing them.
Oh, and that's cool.
Yeah,
I totally want to go. They've got some of the paintings up online on like Funny or Die, I think, and it looks totally cool, and I want to go. But gasoline costs $73 a gallon now, and it's rough. It's very rough.
Right.
I might have to get a horse and a buggy and go that way.
So the next piece of nerd news that I have is it looks like Seth Gordon, the director of the one of my favorite documentaries of the last 10, maybe even 20 years, The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, is set to direct a remake of the 1983 thriller War Games, which kind of makes sense if you saw King of Kong, which is about 80s, you know, computer games as well, whereas, you know, in arcade form, this is about 80s computer games that end up setting up World War III. Seth Gordon recently wrapped up directing Horrible Bosses with Colin Farrell, Kevin Spacey, Jason Bateman, and Jason Sudeikis, which is set to hit theaters here very shortly. And he also did Four Christmases with Reese Witherspoon, which, you know, kind of was a chink in the armor. But nevertheless, I really like that King of Kong. In fact, I was actually playing Donkey Kong yesterday in the arcade. mainly because of that movie.
Really? I was playing Arkanoid yesterday at Barcade.
Me too, yeah.
It was so good.
Excellent. So, but yeah, so nevertheless, I like the original War Games with Matthew Broderick. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that movie. It's cheesy, but it's fun. And a little bit of nostalgia towards it because I used to watch it all the time when it was on cable when I was a kid. But nevertheless, this slightly piqued my interest, A, because I like Seth Gordon, and because I like the original War Games, but, you know, probably will end up more Four Christmases and less King of Kong. So we'll see how
yeah,
it goes.
Yeah, I don't get how you can do this movie now. Like, back in 1988 or whatever, like, people didn't really know how computers or, like, an internet worked. But now people do know how that kind of stuff works. And, I mean, unless they're going to get real scientific with it, which they're, of course, not, I wouldn't assume anyway. Like, people are... Within the first 5 minutes, people are going to be like, oh, this is dumb. There's no way you could do that.
He'll probably set up World War III via his Twitter account or something.
Yeah, you could probably do that. People are real dumb on Twitter.
But yeah, nevertheless. You know, it's funny how, like, these cyber movies age really badly. The other night, I caught a few seconds of that movie, The Net, with Sandra Bullock on cable. And it is hilariously dated. Just some of the stuff in it. It's like, oh, brother. But yeah, so this will probably fare the same way.
We should probably do a theme show of movies with outdated technology. Like, outdated, like, fear of the internet technology.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, hackers.
Yeah, obvious.
Yeah.
Hackers does not hold up. I watched it a couple years ago, and it is one of the worst things I've ever seen.
So the next piece of nerd news that I have is it looks like Tobey Maguire is being sued over a multi-million-dollar illegal poker game. Leonardo DiCaprio, Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon have also been implicated. The Spider-Man star Tobey Maguire is among more than a dozen high-profile Hollywood people being sued in connection with a Mega Millions illegal gambling ring that ran high-stakes underground poker games, Star Magazine has reported. Maguire, 35, won more than $300,000 from a Beverly Hills hedge fund manager who embezzled investors' funds and orchestrated a Ponzi scheme in a desperate bid to pay off his monster debt to the star and others, it's alleged. So yeah, apparently there's this huge underground poker scene in Hollywood, like I said, involving people from Tobey Maguire to Leonardo DiCaprio, Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon. I don't know. This doesn't really strike me as particularly surprising, considering, you know, who would have thought all these millionaire, you know, yuppie douchebag kids, actor kids, would be involved in some sort of, you know, gambling nonsense. But nevertheless, I thought this was amusing, and it'll be interesting to see who else gets implicated in this. I'm sure Jeremy Piven was lurking around in the corner somewhere during all this retardedness. But yeah, did you guys hear about this story at all?
I did not, but it's good that we're going after these guys and not criminals.
Right. So
it's good that we've got our priorities in check.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes right down to it, who are they harming? What's a few $1,000 between friends?
Yeah. But I kind of do hope that Tobey Maguire goes to jail for a long time because Spider-Man 3 sucked.
Yeah, and Tobey Maguire would be hilarious in prison.
That's true. He'd be walking around with emo hair, pointing at people.
He wouldn't be doing a lot of walking.
Yeah, that's probably true. But he wouldn't be doing a lot of sitting either.
Yeah.
If you catch my drift.
Yes, totally.
If you pick up what I'm throwing down there.
In other weird celebrity news, Brady Bunch mom got crabs in an affair with New York mayor is a headline that caught my eye. The story says it would have made an interesting episode of the Brady Bunch. Florence Henderson, the actress who played perky mom Carol Brady in the beloved family sitcom, says she once got crabs after a one-night stand with career politician John Lindsay, who was the mayor of New York City at the time. Henderson, now 77, recounts in her upcoming memoir that she was cheating on her husband during the 1960s and gave into her better judgment when her married and unattractive friend put the moves on her over drinks in the Beverly Hills Hotel. I don't know why they got to say unattractive. That's like hitting below the belt. The guy, sorry for coming out, this guy had crabs. Anyway, Florence Henderson says, I was lonely. I knew it wasn't the right thing to do. So what did I do? I did it. She writes in Life is Not a Stage for that's coming out this September. Henderson also addressed the issue of whether or not she had an off-screen affair with Barry Williams, who played her eldest teenage son, or stepson, Greg Brady, but she dispels those rumors and says that's not true. But nevertheless, I just like the fact that Florence Henderson was running around screwing married men and getting crabs while starring in the Brady Bunch. It's interesting what goes on behind that curtain.
Yeah, she always seemed like the slutty one on the show.
Yeah. And the last piece of nerd news I have this week is it looks like Hulu is going up for sale. Moving from a rumor to hard fact today, Hulu was put up for sale. Why seems to be the big question, and not a lot of people can find out why. It all started with a report from the Wall Street Journal that the company had received an unsolicited offer to buy it out. No names have been mentioned as to who the potential suitor might be, but then rumors started circulating that it could be Yahoo or, you know, any number of potential buyers. So who knows what this will mean for Hulu. If you watch a lot of stuff online, maybe it'll mean more movies coming its way. Maybe the content will get shittier. Who knows? But nevertheless, we got a Kickstarter account for Junk Food Dinner to buy Hulu. If you want to see nothing but... No, that's not true.
Humanimal videos.
Yeah, just be all Humanimal and Samurai Cop clips all the time. Ninja 3 The Domination would have its own page, and it would be wonderful. But yeah, so nevertheless, hopefully it'll get purchased by someone that understands, you know, that streaming media is the way to go, and we'll see a lot of cool movies and TV shows make its way to Hulu. Otherwise, it may just be total shit fest, and Hulu might go away forever. So, either way, we'll be alright. Yes.
Yeah, I never watch anything on Hulu. I don't know. I guess maybe I should. They've got the first three seasons of Dream On, which is pretty exciting. But I have no idea what's going on over there, aside from that.
Yeah.
It doesn't Saturday Night Live or something?
Yeah, they got like Saturday Night Live. That's how I watched The Daily Show without cable, which is nice. Yeah. But other than that, yeah, it's not worth a hill of beans. All right, well, let's get into some of the cool stuff on DVD and Blu-ray this week. The first DVD we have is Sucker Punch from earlier this year, directed by Zack Snyder, starring Abby Cornish and Emily Browning. Born from the creative vision of filmmaker Zack Snyder, who did Watchmen 300 and the Dawn of the Dead remake, this epic action fantasy launches from the vivid imagination of a young girl whose dream world provides the ultimate escape from her darker reality. Locked away against her will, Baby Doll, played by Emily Browning, has not lost her will to survive. Determined to fight for her freedom, she urges four fellow captives, outspoken Rocket, played by Jenna Malone, street-smart Blondie, played by Vanessa Hudgens, and fiercely loyal Amber, played by Jamie Chung, and reluctant Sweet Pea, Abby Cornish, to band together and try to escape their terrible fate at the hands of their captors, Blue, Madame Gorky, and the High Roller. I don't know. A lot of people said this was terrible. A lot of people said this was good. This is another one, kind of like Drive Angry, that I really begged a lot of people to go see this in the theater with me, and nobody wanted to. Now, this is available on DVD, and the Blu-ray is the unrated extended version, so it upgrades the PG-13 rating to an R rating, which I don't know what all that gets you, but nevertheless, could be intriguing. This seems just like an American version of movies that they've been making in Japan for years. But nevertheless, you know, I like girls with swords and kicking ass, so it might be a fun kind of popcorn movie to watch one evening. Did you guys see this or hear anything about it?
Well, I saw it.
Oh, you saw it?
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I really wanted to see it. And I was taking a cab once, and the cab driver had a bootleg of it going on the video screen in the back of his cab. So I saw like 5 minutes of it, and... you know, it was fine. There was some... I feel like it came up the other day that there was some song that I was really surprised was in it. And I can't think of what it is. But yeah, I still want to see this. I'll probably check it out. Although I think it's dog shit that the Blu-ray is unrated and the regular DVD is not.
That's how they're getting you.
They're not getting me.
Well, that's how they're trying to get you.
Yeah, well, good thing I don't care enough about Sucker Punch to buy a Blu-ray player.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Like, it's a Zack Snyder movie, so it's, like, real picturesque. Like, there's a lot of slow-motion action and pretty stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I was expecting.
Yeah, I mean, like, the plot's not astounding, and the characters aren't astounding. But, man, if you want to see beautiful shots of broads killing Nazi zombies, this is for you.
Yeah, sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it does sound good.
Next DVD we have is The Warrior's Way from 2010. starring Kate Bosworth and Dong Gun Jang. Fugitive Asian assassin Yang journeys from the Far East to the Wild West, where he holes up in a tiny town in the American Badlands. There he meets local drunk and ex-fighter Ron, played by Jeffrey Rush, as well as beautiful circus knife thrower, played by Kate Bosworth, with a dark secret. Danny Hudson and Tony Cox co-star and writer-director Sing-Mu Lee's gripping hybrid of martial arts and Western genres. So I heard this was pretty good. I haven't really seen too much about this, but it looked like one that, you know, I like martial arts. I like Western, so could be interesting. Have you guys heard anything about this?
No.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about it, but one day I went to go to the movie theater, and this was playing, and Faster was playing. And it took me like 20 minutes to decide, because the trailer for this looked really cool.
Yeah.
But maybe I should have seen it.
Circus Knife Thrower.
Yeah, since I still can't really decide if I like Faster or not after seeing it like two or three times.
Yeah, maybe this one would have been more decisive for you.
Yeah.
Next one we have is Zombie Holocaust, coming out on Blu-ray and DVD combo pack this week from 1982. When Manhattan morgue assistant Lori, played by Alexandra DiLacolli, discovers a hospital worker feasting on corpses, she and Dr. Peter Chandler, played by Ian McCullough, trace the source of the cannibalistic activity to a remote island in this campy gore fest from Italian director Mariano Girolami. Chandler leads an exploration team to investigate, but the group finds themselves in harm's way when they become surrounded by cannibals and zombies. So this is, you know, Italian zombie flick from the early 80s, much like several other offerings that are out there. This hasn't been available on DVD here in the States for a while, so if you're a fan of that kind of cinema, definitely check that out. Next DVD we have is Nightmares, a.k.a. Stage Fright, from 1980. This is from John Lammond, the infamous producer-director of Felicity, Australia After Dark, and ABC of Love and Sex, comes a depraved melange of sex, murder, and psychotic mayhem. Jenny Newman of Hell Night and Mistress of the Apes fame stars as a frigid young theater actress traumatized by her mother's horrific death years earlier. But when a series of brutal stabbings rocks her latest production, the drama queen, prone to bloody hallucinations, fears that she herself may be the killer. This was featured in the Ozploitation documentary, Not Quite Hollywood, and it looked pretty interesting. So this has never been available in the United States, other than I think on a edited VHS version, but this is the full uncut, unreleased version of Nightmares, aka Stage Fright, from 1980. Not to be confused with several other movies that are also called Nightmares. This is the Australian 1980 horror film. So I haven't seen it, but this looks really cool, and I like that that John Lammond, and yeah, could be one worth checking out.
Yeah, that sounds all right.
Yeah. Next DVD we have is The Nesting from 1981. This is another kind of lost early 80s horror classics. This is being released by Blue Underground on DVD and Blu-ray this week. A writer suffering from agoraphobia rents an isolated house so she can concentrate on her writing. She doesn't know that her house is a former brothel and inhabited by the ghosts of dead prostitutes. So if you like hookers and you like ghosts, hey, why not make it a hooker ghost evening with The Nesting from 1981?
That sounds like the best way to spend an evening.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're going to be
haunted and scary.
Right, if you're going to be haunted by a ghost, they might as well be prostitute ghosts.
You get that right.
Next weird forgotten cult classic coming to DVD for the first time this week is The Baby from 1973. The description says, an A-list director, a jaw-dropping storyline, and depraved depictions of suburban violence, 70s fashions, and sick love. The result remains one of the most disturbing movies in Hollywood history. Anayante Comer, the loved one, stars as an idealistic L.A. County social worker who investigates the case of Mrs. Wadsworth, former 50s starlet Ruth Roman of Strangers on the Train fame, her two buxom daughters, and son Baby, a mentally disturbed man who sleeps in a crib, eats in a high chair, crawls, balls, and wears diapers. But what secrets of unnatural attachment and sexual obsession are all of these women hiding? Marina Hill of Godfather Part 2 and Michelle Paddocky of Grave of the Vampire co-star in the psychotic stunner from director Ted Post, who did Magnum Force Beneath the Planet of the Apes, now fully restored in its original film negative for the first time ever. So, The Baby from 1973. If you want to see a grown man act like a baby, pick it up.
Did you say crawls, balls?
Yeah, like B-A-W-L.
I know.
He crawls and balls.
Yeah, like plays basketball.
Yeah, he's a baller.
Oh. Well, that's interesting.
Yes. We've also got Bloody Birthday from 1981 making its DVD debut. Get ready for the rarely seen slasher classic from the 80s that has also been the may also be the most disturbing killer kids movie in Grindhouse history. Three babies are simultaneously born at the same hospital at the peak of a full solar eclipse. 10 years later, these adorable youngsters suddenly begin a kiddie killing spree of stranglings, shootings, stabbings, beatings, and beyond. Can the town's grown-ups stop these pint-sized serial killers before their blood-soaked birthday bash?
Let's hope so.
Yeah. But, it looks like this, you know, I love killer kids movies. And anytime you have, like, a 4-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid strangling people, I think it makes for good cinema. So I will definitely be checking out Bloody Birthday from 1981. The last long-lost Grindhouse classic making its way onto DVD this week is Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man from 1976.
Yeah. That's a good title.
Yeah, this is directed by Ruggero Dondado, the Italian director of Cannibal Holocaust, House at the Edge of the Park, and The Barbarians. Attached to a special anti-crime unit, two wisecracking, cynical, and lethally determined Italian detectives cut a wide swath as they ruthlessly pursue their targets. They believe in doing whatever it takes to stop the baddies, even murder. So I like that this has the word baddies in the description.
Yeah, and everything about this sounds good. Cannibal Holocaust, House at the Edge of the Park, both pretty great. I'm going to have to watch this.
Yeah, if you want to see that director, take a stab at the wisecracking cop genre.
Yeah. And baddies.
And baddies, all the way. last DVD I have is Tetsuo, the Bullet Man from 2009. Anthony is a bland and cautious American office worker living in Tokyo with nothing exceptional about him, or so he thinks. When his young son is killed, Anthony begins a violent and bizarre metamorphosis, his flesh transforming into metal, his body expressing and repressing rage and lust for revenge. Anthony is becoming the weapon that will destroy the man who killed his son, and if his rage cannot be contained, the entire city in the process. Cult director Shinya Sakamoto Tetsuo trilogy comes full circle with Tetsuo the Bullet Man. I haven't seen any of the other Tetsuo movies. I've heard they're really good, really stylized Japanese violence, which I'm all into. So this is the third one in the trilogy, so now that it's out, maybe I'll rent all three and have a Tetsuo marathon.
And, yeah, I've only seen the first one, but it was great.
Yeah.
So I might have to check out the other two now that they're so readily available.
Absolutely.
Well, there'll probably be a box set sooner than later now that they're all out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I don't know, maybe wait around, but yeah, definitely I mean, if it's as good as the first one.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things, so I'll definitely check this out.
Cool.
All right, and finally, I always like to end the DVDs with some pieces of nostalgia from your childhoods, potentially. We got Reboot, Season 3 and 4 coming out on DVD. I know we talked about this when Seasons 1 and 2 came out on DVD, and Parker, you had mentioned the last couple seasons were the ones where things got really punk rock, huh?
Yeah, that's when stuff gets real.
All right.
It stops being... I mean, it's still a kid's show, but it gets a little more action-packed and a little bit more fun.
Yeah, robots stop being polite and start getting real.
Yeah. And one of them eats the house peanut butter and doesn't buy any new peanut butter.
Oh, man, that sounds like my house, because I always eat my roommate's peanut butter and then they get mad about it.
You're the puck of the house.
Yeah, yeah, I'm... House puck.
And the last DVD is Challenge of the GoBots, the original miniseries from 1984. Now, I never got into GoBots as a kid. I was never even really into Transformers at all either. So,
a Transmorphers fan?
None of the above, yeah. GoBots, Voltron, Transformers. I wasn't into the robots as a youth. So if I wasn't going to like the Transformers, I certainly wasn't going to like the bootleg Transformers, the GoBots. But if you were a fan of the bootleg Transformers, you can pick up the GoBots, the original miniseries, on DVD this week. All right, so we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about our first movie of the evening, I Was a Teenage Zombie from 1987, so stick around.
Junk Food Dinner loves you. We want you to know that we would marry you, and that we would kill your pimp and accidentally steal his drugs and move to Los Angeles with you so we could sell those drugs to Pross and Pincho and live happily ever after. Now that you know how committed we are to you, please commit to us by giving us a good review on iTunes or by subscribing to the show. Good reviews and 5-star ratings help other people find the show. Just get on iTunes and search for Junk Food Dinner.
In a theater full of empty seats, why did you sit by me?
Welcome back to Junk Food Dinner. The first movie we have tonight is I Was a Teenage Zombie from 1987. This is a movie that I first found back in the olden days, like 2000 or something. I would go to Family Video quite a bit. It's a good video chain in the Midwest, I believe. I don't think it goes any farther than that. Maybe it does. But, you know, back sort of when DVDs were obviously becoming the prevalent media, you know, and like all the new releases were only DVDs, Family Video would still have a whole bunch of VHSs of old cool stuff that you could find. And it was a glorious time. Now they don't have that. But one such VHS I stumbled upon in my days going there was this movie. And me and my friend Jono took it home wanting to watch a story about a teenage zombie. I mean, who could blame us? And we immediately found that this movie was totally awesome. And, you know, we decided that we would rent it, you know, as many times as possible. Anytime anybody was over at our house, like hanging out and drinking, we would always be like, hey, we got to go rent I Was a Teenage Zombie. And we did this like 3 or 4 times. And then the big conversion happened where they got rid of all their VHSs and only had DVDs. And then we could not do that anymore. And it's been a sad time. For movies since then in my life, I suppose. But yeah, so I stumbled upon this on eBay one day a couple years ago and got it. And then when we started doing this show, I was like, man, I got to do this at some point, but it's only on this one VHS and it's not on DVD and it's going to be hard to do. And then I stumbled upon it on the interwebs somewhere and I got very excited and picked this movie immediately so that I could share it with everybody. This is a movie that is about a couple of friends. Or a few friends, about 5 friends. The big dance is coming up. They're high schoolers. The big dance is coming up. They need to buy a 1/4 pound of weed, of course, for said event. They can't find it. They talk to this really funny dealer named Moon, who can only get them heroin. and acid and cocaine, all of which he tried last night. He makes a point to tell them. And, you know, but he doesn't have any weed, oddly enough. It's a big dry spell in town, and nobody can get anything like this. So they run into a fellow named Mussolini, who goes by Moose for short, and has Moose written on his belt buckle. And, you know, he's like kind of a skeezy fellow. He's the reason that, like, he got ripped off or something, and that's the reason why nobody has weed. And, you know, so he's all, hey, I can get you guys weed. Look at me. I'm Moose. You can trust me and all this. So they give him all their money. He takes their money, gives them some crap. And so they want to get revenge and get their money back. So they all get baseball bats, and they all go to scare him a little bit. But this backfires, and they end up killing him and throwing him into a river, which is, of course, polluted with radioactive waste. He turns into a zombie and goes after them. He kills one of their friends named the Bird, played by Kevin Nesgoda, who, according to his IMDb page, was born in 1981, which would make him 7 when this movie was made. And I don't believe that, because I think he was like 25. Yeah, so, you know, Moose gets that guy, and then he gets another one of the friends, and they realize the only way that they can combat Moose is to turn one of their friends into a zombie and have a big zombie fight. And that's the crux of this. The main kid who gets turned into the zombie to battle Moose is Dan, and he's also in love with a girl named Cindy Faithful. And so, you know, that's sort of a subplot, his love for her and stuff like that. I think this movie is still terribly fun. I haven't watched it in like 3 years or something, but I think it's super fun. A lot of the gore effects are really cool. There's a face that gets ripped off that is just moi, just creme de la creme of faces getting ripped off in movies. A lot of other fun stuff happens. The zombie Mussolini is very funny. I don't know. It's just a charming, charming film. How did you guys feel about it?
Yeah, I had heard about this movie a lot by virtue of reading Psychotronic magazine. I recently got a huge stack of those and have been thumbing through them. And there was a lot of advertisements for this movie when it was originally coming out in the late 80s on VHS. And there were reviews of it and stuff. And it always seemed kind of cool, but for whatever reason, I guess mostly just because it's so hard to find on home video, I never got a chance to see it. But yeah, I really enjoyed this. It has a very low budget charm to it, but in a good way, kind of like some of the movies that we've talked about before, like, you know, Psychos in Love or Alone in the T-Shirt Zone. It has a very, you know, obvious labor of love feel to it, where everybody involved seems to be doing it because they are into the film and want it to do good. It's very funny. I think the humor in it's, you know, surprisingly top notch for a movie of this budget. I think all the actors do a really good job. Like you said, Steve McCoy, the guy who plays Mussolini, is really funny. One of the weird things about this movie, unlike a lot of zombie movies, it's like when the zombies come back, they're not these brain dead, you know, roaming zombies like we're used to seeing in films. They actually are like cognizant of where they are, and they can talk and form full sentences and stuff. They're pretty much exactly like they were in real life, except, you know, now they're zombies and are a little stronger. But
and they're blue. They turn blue.
Yeah, blue and green. Yeah, and it's funny when it's Mussolini, because he's still, you know, wisecracking and stuff, but it's almost even more funny when Dan comes back as a zombie, and he's like even kind of like oblivious to the fact that he's even a zombie for the first part of it, and that makes for some, you know, funny some funny gags. Most of all, this is a comedy. I mean, the way we're describing it, it might sound kind of like a horror movie, but on its surface, it's pretty much a straight comedy with horror elements to it. It's there are some good kind of crude special effects, like you mentioned the face ripping scene, and there's some other good kind of low budget special effects that are really cool, but for the most part it is just a straight comedy, and a very goofy one at that. There are some kind of like obvious jokes and some real goofy humor, but nevertheless I did find myself laughing out loud several times throughout the film. I actually, oddly enough, found out that I was introduced to this film in an odd way. I actually had the CD of this soundtrack. This has a really cool soundtrack with a lot of kind of late 80s kind of alternative bands like the Violent Femmes and the DBs, the Waitresses, Los Lobos, Alex Chilton. I had the CD of this. I didn't realize it was a soundtrack to an actual movie. I thought I Was a Teenage Zombie was actually just the name of the compilation, but it is in fact the soundtrack to this movie, which I thought was really good. Obviously, the title is an homage to, you know, the 50s movies like I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, which I think is really cool. And yeah, it's just a real funny, really well made, really well acted kind of a cult comedy. It's surprising, this, you know, this movie feels like it should be a trauma movie in a lot of ways. It has a lot of the feel of the early trauma stuff. And I think they were actually trying to go to get this released on trauma because they have a Lloyd Kaufman reference in the movie.
Yeah.
And I guess the director of this movie, John Elias Michalakis, he worked sound on The Toxic Avenger. So there's obviously a lot of like trauma sensibilities in this movie. And I'm surprised it's not on that roster of films, considering some of the other shit that they release. But, you know, this would be a welcome title to their canon. But, yeah, I thought this was really fun. I'll probably go back and watch this a few times more because I really dug this.
Yeah, I was not very familiar with this. I have seen other I Was a Teenage, you know, movies, but this was not one that I had checked out, and I was really into this. I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was really funny, and the gore is good, and it's got that, you know, like you said, it's got that earnest feel to it, like some of the other movies that I've really liked on here, like, you know, T-Shirt Zone, and just the kind of movie where everybody involved really is into it, and wants it to be good, but also kind of knows, you know, what they're doing, and doesn't try to oversell it, which I think is a virtue of this movie. I think that the kids are all pretty great. I like their characters a lot. I really like Bird.
That's Bird,
the,
yeah.
The yeah. Bird, yeah. That's the kid who's 7 years old.
Yeah, I really like his character. I like that he's, you know, he's like this bully, and he kind of comes in and the gang is like, oh, you know, shit, here comes Bird or whatever. And he comes up, and he's like, you got my money? And the kid's like, no, no, but I'll get it. And he's like, okay, cool. So I like that he's like kind of a bully, but he's a reasonable bully. And he's like a bully with a heart of gold. And I don't know. I really like this. I would really like to find a hard copy of this because it's one that I would probably, like you said, watch, you know, at least a few more times and show it to people. So I am pretty happy that you picked this for the show.
Excellent. Yeah, I was. I also thought that it was similar to T-Shirt Zone and Psychos in Love. And as such, I was like, man, Mark is probably going to love this. And if he doesn't, I'm going to be very sad.
Yeah, no, I feel like at this point, there's definitely like a tone that I found in movies that I really find that I appreciate. And this definitely had that in spades. So, yeah, pretty great.
Excellent. One scene in this movie that is not, I mean, it's still like kind of a funny scene and stuff, but I thought it was like kind of a weird scene. One of the kids is like making out with this girl, and Moose attacks them. And then the most campy, slapsticky, humorous rape scene ensues. And I thought it was very bizarre.
Yeah, she seemed pretty into it.
Yeah, she was very into it.
At least initially, until her legs.
Yeah, it was a straw dog sort of thing for a little bit.
I was a teenage straw dog.
Yeah, but I thought that was kind of a weird scene, like that these guys are sitting together and they're like, what can we do that's really funny in the scene? And they're like, yeah, a little rape. That'll be funny. That'll be humorous. Let's do it.
Yeah.
After that scene, the kids get picked up by a cop, and there's this really funny, like, bad cop interrogation scene that I thought was very humorous. And then the kids get picked up later by a different cop for absolutely nothing. Like, for all this cop knows, they're just walking around with walkie-talkies, and then he arrests them, which I thought was also funny.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, while I was watching this movie, at first I was trying to, you know, keep all the continuity straight and, you know, try to see, you know, like, kind of have a realistic bent to it, you know, just like, oh, that would never happen. And then I just realized, you know what, I'm watching I Was a Teenage Zombie. I need to just not take this seriously and just enjoy it. And, yeah, that's, I think, the way you need to approach this movie. But I was really taken aback by the obvious low budget of this. The actors in this were, I thought, were really good. A lot of them had, like, really good comic timing. And there was a lot of, like, really, you know, genuinely laugh-out-loud moments. It wasn't a lot of times I wasn't laughing at how bad the movie was. I mean, I was laughing at the intentional humor of it. And I think that's what kind of sets us apart from a lot of these, you know, kind of low budget horror comedy spoofs that came out in the, 80s video era. Some of them you're laughing at them because of the poor production quality and stuff. But I think this one, I was genuinely laughing at the intended jokes. And I think that's kind of where this movie excels.
Yeah, exactly. I think that all these kids, you know, work really well together. I would buy the fact that they are probably friends. Yeah. So, and I you know, like you were saying, I think that's the mark of what makes this watchable, more watchable than a lot of the stuff that came out around this same time.
Yeah. And it's funny, it's also got Alan Lewis Rickman, who plays Lieberman, who's like one of the, like, the dumb comic relief guys in this movie. He was also in, like, Slime City as Horace. But he's kind of gone on to have a semi-legitimate career, you know, including stuff like A Serious Man and Boardwalk Empire and, like, the Jack Kevorkian biopic, You Don't Know Jack, starring Al Pacino. So I just thought it was funny that this guy who was, like, this kind of, like, goofy, almost retard character in I Was a Teenage Zombie has gone on to have the most successful career out of anyone in this movie.
Yeah, a lot of the like main core of guys in this movie have gone on, like, this is their only thing on IMDb. But then there's that guy, like you said, and then the guy who played Gordy went on to write and produce a bunch of like Ramones documentaries, which seems bizarre. So it's weird the things that these guys have gone on to do or not gone on to do. Like, especially with these guys being, like you guys said, like, you know, their comic timing is good, like they're good actors, like, you know, are certainly better than what is to be expected from type of movie. Like, for a lot of them to not do anything and then for others to go on and have like these kind of weirdo careers documenting the lives of the Ramones.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Probably the most surprising for me, I looked up Steve McCoy, the guy who played Mussolini, and this is his only acting credit, which is astounding to me. I thought he would have like a whole slew of appearances as like a character actor playing, you know, tough crime guys, but not the case, unfortunately, because I'd like to see more stuff with him in that.
Yeah, no, I'd love to see him in more movies. He's very funny in this.
The only thing I wanted to say, I mean, this does have an awesome soundtrack. Definitely, if you guys haven't heard it in its entirety, go check it out. I think that was kind of like, you know, when I saw a lot of the advertisements for this movie, more so than actually playing up like the actors in it, which were obviously not big names or anything like that. It was like, you know, I Was a Teenage Zombie featuring music from, and it like lists all the people on the soundtrack rather than any of the actors or the director or anything. So I think that was like one of the main selling points of the movie. And I think the soundtrack, like I said, has kind of lived on a little bit more in infamy than the movie itself, which is a shame because I think it's one that definitely could be rediscovered by if you like, you know, early Troma stuff and you know, just kind of goofy horror comedies. I think you'll definitely find something to love here.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to like in this, and I'm actually kind of surprised this doesn't have a bigger. Well, I'm sure a lot of people really like this, but I'm kind of surprised it doesn't have a more, you know, official release and isn't more recognized.
I agree. Yeah, that does it for I Was a Teenage Zombie. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to talk about the Manson family.
Sometimes after watching terrible movies like The Time Changer, Slip the Zandice to your junk food dinner hosts get the blues. They become suicidal and cry deeply all day long like women during a Drew Barrymore movie. The only thing that can make Kevin, Mark, and Barker feel better is more fans on Facebook. Please take a moment of your time and go like Junk Food Dinner on Facebook. Each time someone clicks the like button on the JFD page, it puts a smile on the faces of these movie nerds.
That looks good. That looks really good.
There's a time for living. The time keeps on flying. Think you're loving, baby, and all you're doing is crying. Can you feel? Are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl. Look at your game, girl. What a mad delusion. living in the confusion, frustration and doubt. Can you ever live without the game? The sad, sad game. Just to say your love's not enough. If on you can't be true, you can tell those lies, baby, but you're only fooling you. Can you feel, are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl.
Welcome back to Junk Food Dinner, episode 65. Up next on the program is The Manson Family from 2003, directed by Jim Van Bever, who is a native of Dayton, Ohio.
Yeah.
This is a film, it's pretty straightforward. It pretty much dramatizes the events of the 1969 Manson family murders, and interspersed throughout that are scenes from a America's Most Wanted type show talking about the Manson family and a new cult of kids going after the people making that show. The real meat of this, though, are the reenactments and interview-style footage of the Manson family. Jim Van Bever funded this on his own, which apparently was a great deal more trouble than he had anticipated. He actually also plays the role of Bobby in this film. And, yeah, this is a pretty nutty movie that I just picked up when I was working at the video store. This was one that I bought after it got marked out, having heard that this guy was from Dayton and being pretty into, you know, real life serial killer stuff. I thought I would check it out. And it's totally zany. The footage has a really grainy and saturated look to it. There's a lot of really crazy kind of editing and sound manipulation and stuff, which I am very into. There's not a lot of new stuff in this. It's all, you know, if you're familiar with, you know, the Manson family story and have seen those interviews and stuff, none of this is very new, but it's very stylized, very crazy kind of footage. There's a lot of really cool kind of camera work and a lot of things kind of loop to kind of give you like this disoriented feeling. But yeah, I like this movie quite a bit. Jim Van Bever has done some other things. He did a film called Deadbeat at Dawn, which I have not seen, but have heard good things about. I've read some interviews with him. There's an interview with him in that Dark Stars Rising book that I put up in the blog a few months ago, where he talks about this. He talks about a film he made, or a trailer for a movie he tried to make called Roadkill, which sounded pretty nuts and that I think he would probably still be trying to make. The interview was from right before this came out, so he was pretty excited about that. I don't know. There's, like I said, not a lot of new stuff in here, just kind of a stylized look at that. And, yeah, what did you guys think of this?
Unlike you, I'm not a huge fan of real-life serial killers or... not that you're obsessed with them or anything. I just... I don't want to give that impression. But I've never really found any interest in like reading about like Ed Gein or the Manson family or anything like that. Stuff doesn't appeal to me. There's been some good, you know, biopics on some of them, and you know, serial killer stories in general are right. But anytime I'm watching something like this, there's always like a level to it where I'm like, the real people got killed, and I don't know if I should like be reveling in like a horror style movie about it. Maybe I'm being, you know, overly sensitive, but nevertheless, it because it's real, it always has a tinge of like kind of creepiness whenever I watch these kind of movies. Nevertheless, I thought this movie was really well made. You know, I had heard about this kind of peripherally just because it was made by a guy who was from Dayton, Ohio, and I guess it was filmed, a lot of it was filmed in Dayton and in the Cincinnati area, just in various kind of secluded locations, and a lot of local actors and stuff. This was a labor of love, like you mentioned. This took several years to get made. I think he actually started working on this movie sometime in like the late 80s, and it took him, you know, almost, 15 years or so before this was even close to being completed. I guess Blue Underground helped fund in the later part of it just to get it released.
Yeah, yeah. He mentions that in that interview.
Yeah, and nevertheless, this never had a very disjointed feel to it. It always felt very fluid. There's always a clear sense of style and a clear sense of execution that was very strong throughout this movie. I think, if nothing else, even if you don't particularly like the subject matter of this film, or you're not into horror movies, or you know, particularly graphic, you know, stuff like that, you will find that Jim Van Bever is a very talented and skilled director. And there's a lot of scenes in this that I thought were really impressive just from a visual aspect of it. I thought he did a really good job of creating the 60s, you know, aesthetic and look, especially in, like you said, the grainy film stock and the costumes, the set design, stuff like that. Some of the footage, I mean, if you would have told me it was actually shot in the 60s or 70s,
yeah,
I would not have a hard time believing it. A lot of times, especially on low budget stuff, when they try to do a period piece, there's always glaring mistakes, and the feel doesn't seem right, and it doesn't feel like they're capturing the era in which they're portraying. This never had that problem. I thought they did a great job of capturing the era of the 60s in a way that was always believable throughout it. I never was like, oh, this seems so, you know, it's fake.
Right.
But lots of, you know, interesting things to watch. I thought all the actors in this were very good for people that were getting paid little to no money and
Bupkis.
Yeah,
yeah.
And were just kind of locals. There's a lot of sex and nudity in this movie. There's a lot of orgy scenes. There's, you know, some really graphic depictions of murder. There's some really creepy kind of rape scenes, and you know, as you would expect from the Manson story. There's a lot of scenes in here that kind of reminded me of Oliver Stone as directing, especially in something like Natural Born Killers. Some of the psychedelic elements of it definitely had that kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, the filters and the color saturation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all of it, I mean, it made for a very pretty picture. You know what I mean? I think it, despite the grim and gritty nature of the storyline, the visual look of it was really good. I thought the actors did a good job. And I was intrigued throughout, despite not being super intrigued by the subject matter of the Manson family. I think if this movie was about something else, maybe if it was just kind of a fictionalized story about this cult in the 60s and wasn't particularly about the Manson family, I might have enjoyed it more. But nevertheless, I thought this was a good effort and really solid piece from Jim Van Bever, and I really hope he gets to work on some more stuff because I really like his visual style, and I think he could do a lot with a solid budget. So hopefully we see a lot more from him in the future.
Well, I think a lot of that kind of visual style comes from the fact that he was a music video director in addition to, you know, doing his other features and stuff. He did a lot of Skinny Puppy videos, and then they ended up doing a bunch of the soundtrack for this as well, which the music in this is zany, and it's a very present, it has a real presence throughout the film, and I think it adds to a lot of the scenes. He's a very good eye, like you said, you know, for this kind of style, and his timing, I think, is also very good, you know, because I think he also edited this.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he did. So I think that probably had a lot to do with it.
I never saw this movie. hanging around the circle of friends that I had when this movie came out. They were all super stoked. They were like, it's time for the Manson movie! They, you know, I hang out with a lot of punk rock gothic kids, and they were all super stoked on this. And but I never got around to seeing it. I've never been too interested in Charles Manson. I almost said Marilyn Manson. which I guess shows you how into Charles Manson I am, is that he's the second Manson I think of. So I mean, I don't know. I do like serial killers and stuff. I'm more of a Bundy man myself. I like that Bundy movie that Corin Nemec was in. So yeah, so you know, I don't know too much about Van Beber. A lot of people I know are seriously into him, and I believe he directed a video for My Latex Brain, which is one of my favorite bands in Dayton and good buddies of mine. But
cool.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he did. He was supposed to, or maybe he did. I forget. I don't know. I'm pretty sure he did, though. Yeah, so I don't know. It took me a minute to get into this movie because, you know, all the, like, weird cuts and the psychedelic stuff happens at the beginning, and I'm, you know, I was, like, trying to get into it at the beginning rather than be bombarded with all this cool visual stuff. So I was, like, kind of frustrated at the beginning. That, you know, not really knowing much about Charles Manson stuff because it never really interested me. Like, I was like, let me understand who these people are and then bombard me with all this crazy stuff, please. But once I got into it, you know, then the psychedelic stuff and the weird cuts and all the crazy imagery really added to the film. So, I mean, I liked all that stuff, like you guys said. One thing I liked a lot about this movie is that Carl Day was in it. And that's one thing, that's how I could tell it took a long time to make this movie, is because Carl Day, he was like a broadcaster in Dayton for many, many years until dying recently. He was very, very young in this movie. And I was like, oh, so cute, Mr. Carl Day. Being young, you know. So yeah, it was cool to see him, because if you've grown up in Dayton, you're acutely aware of who Carl Day is, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, this is really fun. The acting was really good, like you said. I don't know, I mean, not being in, like, if I was, like, super into Manson, like, I assume the people who see this movie are, I obviously would have liked it a lot more. But being as this is, you know, I mean, I would have probably much rather have watched, like, a real documentary or, like, a real biopic rather than, like, a pseudo-documentary. Yeah. Because
it's interesting that you say that, because I also have a DVD that I found at a thrift store that's just called Manson that has a lot of the archival footage, you know, a lot of these actual interviews on it. And it's very, very interesting how close they got to some of these things, you know, in tone and style and everything. So that was a big thing for me, where I was, you know, able to see these side by side, and they're both pretty close. The one scene that I really like is when the girls are coming down the courthouse steps and they have all their heads shaved and they're kind of walking in that triangle down the stairs, just like staring straight ahead. I think that's super creepy. And I like in this the way that, you know, it was like black and white and kind of washed out and looked very alien. It looked like a 50s, you know, kind of sci-fi movie. And I thought that kind of like stark visual was really cool. So sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's quite all right. Yeah. I like that scene a lot too. I like, the visuals of that were really cool. And then another thing I liked about this movie and sort of the theme and tone of it were that the killings weren't, you know, these, you know, like, weren't these Hollywood type of things where, you know, you just put a knife in somebody and they're like, oh, I'm dead. Like, these were like real horrible, brutal, you know, things. Like, you know, these people were just stabbing and stabbing and stabbing. These people wouldn't die, and you know, they were gurgling and making these crazy sounds, and it was like not a pretty thing, like you know, in most movies like this you would expect.
Yeah, a lot of brutality in this movie. I mean, in terms of the murder and the rape, a lot of stuff that was kind of hard to watch, but I think, you know, it did a good job in terms of presenting the grimness of the actual events in that manner.
Yeah, it didn't really revel in it, you know. And I, in something I read, in the Sharon Tate, you know, murder scene, he didn't want to show a pregnant woman getting stabbed in the stomach, which is why they did a lot of that one off screen. So, you know, I think for as gory and kind of graphic and stuff as this is, that it was also relatively restrained, you know, like, you know, it's not really celebrating this. It's more just kind of, you know, showing it, you know, it's a, like a historical movie rather than just like a straight up horror movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, one thing about this. Now, when I was watching this, I didn't know too much. I mean, I know the basic history of the Manson family and stuff. But, I mean, so this is pretty historically accurate in terms of... Because that's one thing that I was always kind of confused about when watching this was how much liberties they had taken with the actual story. If this was supposed to be kind of a dramatized version of it, or if they were trying to stick to the facts as close as possible and make it a straight biopic. Because... I was kind of curious about that when I was watching it, if how accurate this really was. Do you know? I mean,
I'm not sure. And I feel like it's really hard to say about any of that stuff, you know, because of, you know, so much urban legend and it's probably pretty difficult to get the truth out of any of the actual Manson family.
Yeah, not a lot of credible sources.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of embellishment and just kind of urban legend at this point have gone into that. So, you know, it's really difficult to say, but, you know, so I would, you know, from what I've read and seen, you know, in terms of interviews and stuff, it, you know, seems like they tried to stay pretty close to the source.
Right on.
Well, that just about wraps it up for our discussion of 2003's The Manson Family. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to body slam you off the top rope.
Tired of only hearing your junk food dinner hosts talk to you? You want to start talking to them? Then pick up your Zach Morris-like cellular phone and dial 347-746-JUNK. That's 347-746-5865. Leave us a message about the movies we've talked about. Did we give a good review to a movie you think sucks? Did we take a crap on your favorite movie? Let us know. Or call it to suggest a movie, or tell us why you hate LeBron James. Remember to leave a name and the city you represent when you call. We're very lonely, and rarely hear the voices of other humans.
So dial this number now if you dare. Tell them that he sent you.
Welcome to the world of Harry Smilak.
M. Harry Smilak, personal management, at your service.
A world of fancy cars and fabulous women.
Have you ever considered a career in modeling?
He's got everything money can buy. The trouble is, it's not his money.
Oh! Mr. Kim from the Fusang Savings and Loan, the Vice President, corrections.
Corrections?
I correct money from dipsticks like you.
He's a mover.
Smoking
and a shaker.
I've been thinking about our relationship.
What relationship?
A wheeler.
I'm Harry Smilak.
Ow!
And a dealer.
So tell me, does my man have a t-shirt or a shoe deal?
He's a legend.
Whatever it is, the answer is absolutely not.
What do you want from me?
$67,811.19 to be very specific.
Then, one day, he took some punts.
What do you think is the number one thing on M. Harry Smilak's mind?
M. Harry Smilak.
Added some hunks.
You're a dead man, Smilak!
And created Rock and Roll Wrestling.
You don't have to thank me, it's just another Smilak service.
A comedy with muscle. Body slam.
Oh,
Hey, guys.
Trust me.
Welcome back to Junk Food Dinner, episode 65. The final film we're going to be taking a look at tonight is Body Slam from 1986. This is a movie that I had never seen prior to picking it for the show, and was one that I was kind of intrigued about. I generally don't go for PG-rated comedies from the 80s unless I have some sort of nostalgic attachment to it. And this one did have the allure of featuring many professional wrestlers from the era, and so that was kind of the in. I had read a review of this in the book that we seem to always be talking about, Destroy All Movies, and it talked about how it was a mixture of rock and roll and wrestling, and I was under the impression when I picked this movie that it was about wrestlers that form a band and rock out, which sounded, you know, very morbidly, in a very morbid curiosity kind of way, intriguing to me. But this is not the case. This movie is mostly about Dirk Benedict, who plays a character named M. Harry Smilak. You might remember Dirk Benedict as Face from the A-Team. He is this, you know, sleazy, yuppie music producer who seems to have the whole world against him. He's, you know, having troubles with his ladies. He owes money all over the place. He's got Korean gangsters after him looking for money. Seems like everywhere he goes, somebody either wants money or wants him dead. So he's having a real rough go of it. His career as a recording exec is or a band manager is obviously not going too hot. So he somehow happens upon a meeting between Rowdy Roddy Piper, who plays Quick Rick Roberts, and one of his agents, and it seems that Rick isn't getting the proper management that he should be. Harry steps in and asks to represent him under the impression that he is a rock and roller, not a wrestler. When he finds out that he is in the wrestling profession, he's kind of taken off guard, but tries to see if he can work the same magic that he had in the music industry on the pro wrestlers. He quickly becomes a favorite amongst the wrestlers, which does not sit well with Captain Lou Albano, who's playing Captain Lou Moreno, a rival wrestling manager who does not cotton to Dirk's to Harry's yuppie ways and his new approach to managing wrestlers. So throughout the film, we're treated to a lot of classic wrestlers, like I mentioned, Rowdy Piper, Captain Lou Albano. Then we've got some guest appearances by, you know, people like Classy Fred Blassie and Ric Flair. You know, they all pop up. In addition to that, we also have appearances by some of the late 70s and early 80s B-list celebrities, like Charles Nelson Reilly as a wrestling announcer, which is hilarious. Famous midget actor Billy Barty plays another wrestling manager. We've got John Astin as Scotty, and probably the funniest role in the movie. We've got Tanya Roberts, who a lot of people might remember from Tourist Trap. She was also Donna's mom on That 70s Show. So a lot of interesting pop culture footnotes make appearances here and there throughout the film. Overall, though, this movie is not a whole lot of fun. It spends way too much time on Harry Smilak, who is not a likable character at all. You'd never actually give a shit about a protagonist whatsoever throughout the movie. He's very unlikable, very bad in terms of, you know, protagonists, in terms of somebody to latch onto or somebody to be interested in. The parts with Rowdy Piper are good. As always, you know, we've talked about him and Hell Comes to Frogtown and They Live, and he's always an entertaining watch on screen. A lot of the cameos are funny, but for the most part, this movie just drags along at a snail's pace and doesn't really go anywhere. The music in it was performed by this band called Kick, which is nothing exciting. It's just this cheesy 80s, you know, pop metal, and it's just abysmal. This movie was directed by Hal Needham, who was most famous for directing, you know, all the Burt Reynolds stuff, Smokey and the Bandit. He did Stroker Ace, had, like, the Cannonball Run movies, and all this cheesy action stuff from back in the day. He also directed Megaforce, which is something of a cult classic as well. But, you know, this was obviously trying to cash in on the name recognition of Dirk Benedict, who was recently very popular from his appearance on the A-Team, and the growing popularity of professional wrestling. All in all, it, you know, kind of, like I said, falls flat. It might be interesting if you're a fan of wrestling back in the 80s to see some of these guys appear, but it's not like an all-out wrestling movie, like something like No Holds Barred or something where I think fans of wrestling would be excited by it throughout. It's more just this stupid 80s comedy about this bumbling record producer. So I thought I was fairly disappointed with this, and probably will not be revisiting Body Slam. But how did you guys feel about it?
I had never seen this movie, but you know, I'd heard about it recently and wanted to see it basically because of Roddy Piper, who I love. And this movie is really weird to me, and it's weird sort of in the same way that No Holds Barred was weird to me, in that it's sort of based on like a real thing, but that real thing is based on the idea that it, you know, is real when it is not real, in terms of the outcomes and stuff of wrestling matches. And, so it's just sort of this weird, bizarre reality where you're making, you know, a fictional movie about something that people think is real, and I don't know. But, in this movie, we have this guy who's supposed to be the manager of a couple of wrestlers, but in this movie, they mix up, like, the duties of a manager and a wrestling promoter. Like, I mean, in the world of wrestling, managers are basically just people who are too old to wrestle who, like, come down to the ring with you, and that's the extent of it. But in this, they're, like, putting on shows and getting tour buses together, and, it's like this...
I think that's kind of how wrestling was, though, in before WWF turned it into a big corporation. In a lot of respects, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a lot of self-promotion. You know, Rowdy Piper, he didn't just wrestle strictly for, like, the WWE. Like, back in the day, you'd have to go from circuit to circuit. And I think the duties of the manager were kind of more similar to what they were talking about in this movie kind of back in the day, as opposed to when WWE kind of was an all-encompassing franchise. If that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, you might have had, like, a manager, but he was basically, like, an agent or, like, a talent manager would be. He wouldn't be... Like, if you had a manager, he wasn't your valet and stuff in the ring. I don't think. I mean,
right, yeah.
He was. But, that's kind of weird. And then also you have this weird thing where, these wrestlers, you know, Roddy Piper is playing a fictional character, but then later on we have Freddie Blassie and Ric Flair who are playing themselves, which is another sort of weird, is it real, is it not real sort of thing that goes on in this movie. And so, these movies, and then, I mean, it's not even really an 80s thing, because there was that movie that came out in, like, 1997 with David Arquette that was about wrestling and treated it like it was this real thing where the wrestlers really got mad at each other and really fought and tried to ruin each other's lives. So, I mean, movies like this really just are very bizarre to me that somebody would make. I don't know. It's like if somebody made a movie about the movie War of the Worlds and treated it like it was a real thing or something. It's very bizarre. I don't know. That being said, I like Roddy Piper a lot, and I wanted to like this movie, but it has absolutely no plot at all, and Roddy Piper's really only in it for the montage scenes. You know, in a movie, the best time for a montage is at the beginning to get all your exposition up front, to bring everybody up to speed about what's going on, or at the end of the second act where our protagonist has to, like, go through a lot of life changes in order to face the challenges in the third act, like you'll see a lot in a Rocky movie or something. But the absolute worst time for a montage is the entire third act, and that's what happens in this movie. Once you think that things are about to pick up and there's going to be a plot, no, it's just a huge 20-minute montage. It's like the 45-minute mark to the hour and 15-minute mark or so of just Roddy Piper beating people up in this shitty band playing. And then the last 5 minutes are like the culminating match. This movie is bogus, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I'll get on board the fuck this movie train. I have nothing invested in this. I mean, no, that's not fair. I like Roddy Piper. You know, he's great. But I, you know, as I've stated before, never got into wrestling. So there is nothing in this movie for me, except maybe Charles Nelson Reilly. So there's two people that I like in this. Yeah, I hate the main character. I don't care about his cars. That band sucked. Wrestling is dumb. Yeah, I really did not care for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not funny. Should... Like, the jokes aren't funny. The parts that are so bad that they're funny aren't funny. Yeah, it's just not a good movie. But I still really want to see Megaforce.
Yeah, I should say that I do... well, I mean, not so much now. But, I mean, I have enjoyed wrestling in my lifetime, which is the only reason that I just didn't break my television while watching this movie is... That, you know, if this was about chess players or something, I would have been very...
Yeah, yeah. Right, and I know that you guys, you know, were into wrestling, you know, when you were younger, as per previous discussions, you know, on No Holds Barred and Hell Comes to Frogtown and other stuff featuring wrestlers. But, like, you know, like I said, I had nothing invested in this. And about halfway through, I was like, man, I hope somebody gets killed or something. I hope that little girl turns into a monster and, you know, something... But no, that never happened. There weren't, like, a flying motorcycle in this. There wasn't even, like, good music. So I would suggest never seeing this movie.
Yeah, well, it's funny. When I was reading about this in that book, you know, I was like, how come I've never heard of this before? I mean, it seems like this would be fairly notorious in terms of cult audiences. I mean, it's this movie that combines rock and roll and professional wrestling, and it's got this kind of, like, who's who of, like, you know, like I said, 80s pop culture footnotes like Charles Nelson Reilly and Billy Barty and, you know, just all these kind of weird 80s pop culture staples. So you think this would have at least, even if it's terrible, some sort of, you know, cult following or kind of cult infamy. But I had heard nothing about this. And now I can understand why, because it's not like this movie is ridiculous in its badness and it's just kind of like weird and you got to see it. It's just ultimately just so bland and boring.
Yeah.
That it's not memorable at all. Yeah, I mean, if you saw this on TV in the 80s, you probably have forgotten all about it because there's just absolutely nothing memorable that would stick out in your mind about it. It's just very, very bland. Not even Captain Lou Albano, whose flamboyant presence saved so many, you know, Cyndi Lauper music videos, could put an ounce of personality into this film, unfortunately.
No, it's just bad.
Yeah.
Oh, Gomez was in it for a second. No, that was cool.
Yeah, well, like I mentioned, that was probably my favorite cameo of this whole movie. Probably the only part that I thought had some legitimate humor was when John Astin was on camera kind of hamming it up. And he had just this all too brief scene. He just plays another person in the long line of people that hassle our protagonist. And his stuff was pretty funny. But
yeah, that was, I mean, I like John Astin,
yeah.
And I was like, oh, maybe he'll be a bigger part of this. No, completely wasted. squandered.
Right.
Yeah, in favor of that shitty band.
Right. But yeah, so, you know, I guess it's not any surprise that the director of all the Smokey and the Bandit movies made this kind of bland action comedy. I mean, the Smokey and the Bandit movies are all right, but they just get progressively worse, and this is obviously coming up on a fairly dry spell in director Hal Needham's career. I mean, right before this, he had directed the movie Rad, which I don't know if you guys have ever seen.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Have you guys watched the trailer for Megaforce?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
It looks incredible.
Yeah.
So, I'm kind of scared based on this, but come on. Called Megaforce.
Right.
One interesting thing about this movie is that the Korean businessman, his henchmen are the Samoans, who are, I believe, the uncles of Dwayne Johnson, who I like a lot, and I like his movies generally. And so I think that's the closest we'll ever see to a Roddy Piper, Dwayne Johnson team up in a movie, probably.
There you go.
Yeah. Also, in the credits for this movie, they spelled, you know, like we said, Ric Flair has a little cameo in this movie. They spell his name wrong. They spell it R-I-C-K Flair, which is pretty disrespectful.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah. I don't, you know, that's the thing. It's like, I don't think anybody would be pleased with this movie. Even if you're a diehard wrestling fan, I don't think you're going to like this movie. If you're a diehard A-Team fan, you're not going to like this movie. If you're a diehard Smokey and the Bandit fan, you're not going to like this movie. So it doesn't satisfy any audience.
If you're a diehard bland movie fan, you are going to love Body Slam.
Right.
Yeah. Or if you're a diehard fan of, Billy Barty saying the word faggot a lot.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, that was uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of...
He had a filthy mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. Not the most politically correct movie ever, either.
Oh.
Not that movies should be or anything, but yeah, it's just very, very mid-80s.
Yeah, it was funny, too, because, during that part where Billy Barty is calling our protagonist a faggot, there's a guy, like, they pan, it's on a fake TV show in the movie, and they pan out to the audience, and somebody in the audience has a sign that says faggot.
Yeah, a midget.
Was it another midget?
Yeah.
Midgets are hateful people towards the homosexual community.
Yes, can't wait to get some listener feedback on this review.
I'm not the one who said the midgets are the rats of people.
Whoa.
Hold on, I have two other things to mention real quick. I wanted to mention real quick that there's a scene where these bad guy tag team wrestler guys are beating up Roddy Piper and his partner. And they're beating him up with chains, like really bad, kicking him. There's blood everywhere, beating him with these steel chains. And then they do this other thing where, like, they drop an elbow on Roddy Piper's back. And then at this point, Harry Smilak says, "Hey, that's an illegal move. Never mind." They've been getting beat with chains for the last 20 minutes. And
I was under the impression that was legal in professional wrestling.
Getting hit with chains?
Yeah.
Sometimes it is.
You've seen the Junkyard Dog wrestle, right?
I have. Also, there's a point in this movie, like, the Harry Smilak guy is, like, kind of a shiesty type of a fellow. So when he takes Roddy Piper and his tag team partner under his wing, he gives them the deal that, he'll do this for 15% and $500 a week, which is obviously a pretty bad deal. But there's no part where they resolve that because of their friendship. Like, there's no part at the end where, like, he starts to like them and they're good friends and he's really enjoying this wrestling business that he goes, "Hey, I've been swindling you, but I'm going to stop." No, he's just going to keep on swindling him.
Yeah.
What a jerk.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're looking that deep into this movie at this point, you've gone too far.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. But, I mean, usually in a movie like this, that scene would have happened where they would have realized that they were getting swindled and then, like, had a real friendly bonding scene where they decide to be even Steven for now on or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there was a level of Stockholm syndrome going on between Rowdy Piper and his manager.
That's certainly true.
All right. Well, let's end this madness now and wrap things up for Body Slam. Don't see it.
Yeah, don't ever
we
see it.
We urge
this.
You. All right, so we're going to
watch,
take...
Yeah, just watch I Was a Teenage Zombie 2 times instead.
Right. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to say goodbye to all of you beautiful zombies.
And hateful midgets.
All right, well, that just about wraps up episode number 65 of Junk Food Dinner. We'd like to thank everybody for tuning in and listening. Make sure you tune in next week. We're going to have another round of fan appreciation. We're going to be taking a look at a couple movies recommended to us by listeners over the past couple weeks. We're going to be looking at Retribution from 1987, Megaforce from 1982, directed by our new favorite director, and Gutterballs from 2008. So that should be a lot of fun, and we look forward to watching these fan-recommended films. So if you have a recommendation for the show, be sure to drop us a line at jfdpodcast@gmail.com. It doesn't have to be a recommendation for the show. You can just tell us what you think of the show, or if you have any feedback about a movie we watched, or if you do have a movie you'd like to see us review, send us an email at jfdpodcast, or even better, pick up your phone and give us a call on the Junk Food Dinner hotline at 347-746-JUNK. That's 347-746-5865. Give us a call, leave us a voicemail, let your voice be heard, and we'll probably play the voicemail on the show, unless you drop a lot of, racial slurs or call us faggots, or...
We're not accepting your cards.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not going to accept any calls from Billy Barty.
Yeah. Also, make sure you're going to junkfooddinner.com. There you can find all of our past episodes. Listen to them right on the site simply by hitting play. If you ever have somebody who says, oh, you should listen to Junk Food Dinner, and you're like, I don't know how to work a podcast, say, just go to the site, hit the play button, and you'll be listening. Also, you can find links to subscribe to us on iTunes if you're a little bit more technically savvy. You can have our podcast delivered directly to your iTunes with a simple click of a button, and it'll update automatically every week so you can have the show for anybody else. Also, while on your website, take the time to vote for what's going to be our 200th movie. The votes are quickly rolling in, and it looks like it's going to be a tight race. So we've got five choices up there, or six choices for you. We've got The Blob from 1988, Candyman, Chud, Enter the Dragon, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and The Toxic Avenger. We're going to do a full-length commentary for our 200th movie, much like we did with our Howard the Duck episode. So whatever movie you want to hear us do a full-length commentary for, go and vote right now. It's neck and neck between Enter the Dragon, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and the dark horse from behind, Chud, who in the past week has really blasted up the charts. Either someone's multiple voting here, or else Chud has a severely lazy fan base that is just now coming out of the woodwork. But nevertheless, there's still plenty of time to vote, so go over to junkfooddinner.com and cast your vote for our 200th movie. All right, so until next time, this is Kevin Moss, Mark Fredo, and Parker Bowman for Junk Food Dinner saying adios, everybody. We will see you next time.